90 years ago tomorrow, a southbound Southern Pacific passenger train bound for Oakland stopped at a tunnel high up in the Siskiyou Mountains. The stop itself was not unusual, but what followed was. There was an explosion, followed by gunfire. When it was over, four members of the train crew were dead of gunshot wounds. Actually, three of gunshot wounds, one of explosion, I suppose. And three young men were the targets of a massive manhunt that took years to bring them to justice. The incident at the tunnel and what followed are the subjects of a new book Rogue Valley resident Scott Mangold put together, Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13, The Autrements Hold Up the Southern Pacific. And Scott Mangold's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange today. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Glad to have you here. Tell us about yourself. You were not a lifelong historian or author, but gravitated toward this, I guess, later in life.
I actually had a 35-year airline career pretty much all over the United States. But from early exposure to trains, my grandparents would make sure that I saw any trains that were in the area. I learned to love them probably a lot more than airplanes. Sometimes I found airplanes kind of boring. 35 years, a history buff the whole time. We were always interested in moving to this area because Southern Oregon is so rich in railroad history, and it's a real opportunity to write about what we encounter down here.
So you mentioned being a history buff. Are you a railroad buff as well?
Primarily a railroad buff, yes. That's my favorite history.
Do you ever apply the term foamer to yourself?
I have, yes.
For the folks who don't know, foamers are it's actually sort of a derogatory name, is that the railroaders applied to the people who foam at the mouth when they see a train?
Yes. There are the foamers, and there are the people that take their railroading so seriously that we call them rivet counters.
Because they really, in fact, do count the rivets and make sure they're highly accurate and all that sort of stuff.
Wonderful people all.
So interesting, though. You had an airline career, but were interested in railroads, and you did hear about the story of what was intended to be a holdup and ended up being a murder of Train 13, as it turned out, wasn't it?
Yes.
Train 13 at Tunnel 13.
At Tunnel 13.
Interesting for folks who are interested in numerology, I guess. But so who did you hear about the story from growing up, and what did you know about it?
I actually stumbled into it. I went to college in Salem. A friend from school and I had gone to some civic function in town one day, and I found an interesting fellow to talk to about our mutual interest in watercolor and oil painting. And after that concluded and my friend and I were walking back to campus, he asked, "Do you have any idea who you were talking to?" "That's convicted killer Ray D'Autrement." This was the first I'd heard. I had other things on my mind at the time, like graduating, and the draft was prominent in my thinking. I pretty much forgot about the D'Autrements and never really heard their story. When I got out of the service, came home in 1973, I found that media in Portland was doing a 25-year commemoration of the incident.
Would have been 50 by then.
50, I'm sorry. Thanks for that. Yes, 50-year commemoration. And TV station up there and the local paper had done quite a series on the crime. And I got interested in it. It was kind of morbid, but I found it interesting, as kids my age do. And I found myself trying to read everything that I could get my hands on. I've been a model railroader much of my life, and I had written some magazine articles. And my first articles on the D'Autrement were magazine articles written back in the 1990s. And I just found myself, by reading whatever I could, more and more interested.
Why do you suppose there is such a level of fascination? I mean, the fact is that, you know, there are lots of crimes that happened 80, 90 years ago that we don't talk about nearly as much as this one. And yet this is, by my count, at least the third book on this particular incident.
Actually, I think it's the fourth, yes.
Is it? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Three were written back during the 1970s. One was written recently, just a few years ago. So mine would be the fifth, if I'm counting right.
Right. So what do you suppose the fascination's all about, though?
I think the significance is that this was an enormous crime. It was a heinous crime. Enormous in the sense that although only four people died, if you can say it that way, it was very brazen. And although other things were going on at the time, the World Series, a devastating earthquake in Tokyo, a loss of a U.S. Navy fleet off of California, several destroyers that ran aground. This was not perhaps the most important thing going on at the time, but it was a major thing. It was something that people would be talking about for years. Four people died. How many people died in Tokyo? Thousands, tens of thousands. But the way these four people died, they were unarmed, they were doing their job, just a horrible way to die. And it didn't have to be that way. Ray was a believer in predestination, what he called the forces of cosmic development, which basically is fate. I don't believe that there is such a thing as fate, at least to the extent of determining why this happened.
It was really more than fate. It was really about largely bad decisions, it seems like, right down the line.
Horrible decisions, yes.
There are three brothers, then, we're talking about here. Ray, Roy. Ray and Roy were twins, were they not?
Yes.
D'Otterman and their younger brother, Hugh?
Those were the three who were involved in the crime. There were actually other brothers. Older brother, Vern. Youngest brother, Lee. Several stories, several ironies about them. And there was a half-brother, Charlie or Chuck, who was born in 1923, to the D'Otterman boy's father and his second wife. So I say there are five and a half D'Ottermans.
Okay. Much more to talk about with Scott Mangold. He's the author of Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13, D'Ottermans Hold Up the Southern Pacific. We'll come back to the story with your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Scott Mangold. He is a Southern Oregon resident and the author of a new book about an old crime. The crime took place 90 years ago tomorrow. It was the intended robbery of Southern Pacific Train 13 en route from Portland to Oakland. Stopped in a tunnel outside of Ashland. When the incident was over, four members of the train crew were dead, and the three people who killed them were on the loose and stayed so for years. The book is called Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13, D'Ottermans Hold Up the Southern Pacific. You can join Scott Mangold in our discussion here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's welcome Eileen and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Scott Mangold.
Hello, Jeff. Some years ago, I was teaching a folklore class in Medford High School, my students interviewed local people, and we published a book of the folklore. A student named John Dressler interviewed a man named Johnny Howard, who was a longtime friend of Ray Ottermont. And it's just his memory of some stories that Ray told him about that robbery and others that they tried to bring off. These boys were hungry and homeless and cold on a rainy day, and they were desperate. And I just thought Johnny Howard or John Dressler, if either of them still around in the community, they might be of interest to your guests to talk with them also.
Judging by the look on Scott Mangold's face, he's talked to at least one of them, so let's find out. Eileen, thanks for the
I don't know if Johnny Howard would still be living. I don't know how old of a man he was, but I think he was old, quite – my students interviewed older people.
All right, Eileen, thank you so much for that call. Very much appreciate it. Scott, had you run across one of these people or both of them?
Oh, indeed. Johnny Howard was a very interesting fellow. He was a detective on the Portland Police Force, kind of eccentric. He had met Ray many years before and was a good friend of Ray. Actually, he and Ray wrote the first book together, Ray doing the talking and Johnny the writing. But Johnny was a wonderful person. Every year he would take a wreath up to the tunnel to commemorate the crime.
He was the one, okay. And I remember seeing that wreath well into the 1990s.
Yes.
Does somebody still do that?
Not that I'm aware of. Johnny died, I'm going to say, about 6 years ago. I may be mistaken. He has been deceased for some time. And after him, there was a gentleman who lived in Ashland, I don't recall the name, who took over for a few years. In recent years, I have not noticed a wreath up there.
So you're very careful in the book, Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13, not to call this a robbery. So they really ended up with nothing, right?
That's exactly right. They found nothing of worth on the train, so it was a holdup, but it wasn't a robbery.
And how far-fetched were their beliefs about what would be contained on this or any other passenger train?
There is some dispute about that. There are always folks who look at the conspirator side of this. There were rumors, and it was believed that the rumors were picked up as Ray traveled from New Mexico to the Northwest, spending nights in hobo camps. There were rumors that this particular train, the San Francisco Express, Southern Pacific number 13, was carrying a large amount of gold. Heavy industry in the Klamath Falls area, in the Siskiyou area, there were occasionally large payrolls that came through. In fact, there's nothing to believe, nothing that has been discovered that would indicate that this was a payroll train or there was anything special about what it was carrying.
All right. So, but the board trains, though, that did carry some. I mean, this is how things moved at the time because the road system was still not terribly well developed in 1923, was it?
Actually, the Pacific Highway was completed through Oregon in about 1913, 1914, and the boys had hoped to use this to their advantage, a fast automobile if they could find one, and this wonderful new highway, the Pacific Highway. It didn't work out for a number of reasons that the highway was of much advantage, but this was kind of an age where transportation was expanding in new areas.
What Eileen was talking about, though, about the brothers being hungry and cold and desperate, what was the truth of their situation? I mean, they really were kind of bouncing around from place to place. And, in fact, we ought to back up a couple steps and talk about where they came from originally. They were not native Oregonians.
No, they were not native Oregonians. They came from Williamsburg, Iowa. Their family moved quite a bit. The father, Paul, couldn't seem to stay in one place for very long. They moved from Iowa to Arkansas, to Colorado, to New Mexico, back to Colorado. Wanderlust, whether it was Wanderlust or the family trying to do better, there was a lot of moving.
And so what had they done successfully, if anything, in the way of careers and jobs and that sort of thing?
Actually, none. And I should back up just a little bit. I didn't answer your whole question. The boys, as Eileen said, were very hungry. They were destitute. But I think it had a lot to do with their attitude towards life. They wanted to supply their parents, who were having a bad time together and eventually divorced, with the means to live a better life. And they were trying to figure out how they could do that. At the time, there was a spate of robberies across the United States, some of them train robberies, and the boys thought, well, we can do that. They pretty much decided that they would rather rob for a living than work for a living. It was their choice.
Was there any one of the three brothers, Ray, Roy, and Hugh, who was the ringleader, the mastermind, the hardened one, where the other two might have gone? I mean, I really don't know about the dynamics of the situation between them.
Yes. Kind of interesting because there's been debate over whether Hugh, who was the youngest of the three brothers, whether he was the ringleader because he had just graduated from high school. He was a good student. He was a thinker. He did show decisiveness in decisions that the boys were making. But on the other hand, Ray was probably the one who spawned the idea. And he was probably the ringleader. He was the philosopher. We mentioned his believing in fate. He was the one who seemed to have perilous experiences. He was in the Washington State Reformatory at one point. But it was probably Ray who was the leader. The boys were hungry because they chose not to go out and find work. That's not entirely correct. They had always been interested in seeking jobs in the woods, the mills. But when the going got tough, and I should mention that the boys were small, they were lightweight and they were short. When the going got tough, they took off looking for an easier way to live if they could find that.
Was there anything in their family background? I mean, you mentioned the fact that there was a troubled home, which and their parents did finally divorce. Was there any other dynamic there that might have contributed here? Was their father involved in criminal activity of any kind, or did they have friends or family acquaintances who were involved in criminal activity?
No, the crime was pretty much isolated to the three boys, the twins and younger Hugh. The father was a barber. He, on the side, painted and decorated homes. They came from a very respectable family in Williamsburg, Iowa. And the idea of crime was the boys. The rest of the family, particularly Mother Belle and Father Paul, were devastated, absolutely devastated. This did, in fact, destroy the family. This was an opportunity for me to discover the other D'Autremonts. I mentioned that there were really five and a half.
Mm-hmm.
One, it turned out, Vern, turned out to be an aircraft careerist. He was a fixed base operator at the Salem Airport. He had a company that sold airplanes, serviced airplanes. But he had a very successful airline career in Salem. The younger brother, Lee, died at a very young age. Ironically, he died the same way that the first fellow at the crime died, gut shot. So there were ironies in the story. But it was the boys' idea to find and live an easier way, hopefully to provide for their family. They were very close. They provided for one another. Certainly there were good aspects, as there are with any family or any individual, but they decided to be bad guys, and they weren't very good at it.
No, not at all. We're talking about the D'Autremont brothers, Ray, Roy, and Hugh, and the famous mail express car robbery on the train, passenger train, went horribly wrong. October 11th of 1923, that is the subject of Scott Mangold's book, Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Did you say why Ray was in the Washington Reformatory?
He was soaked up into this radicalism and radical movement following World War One.
The International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, all
the
that
Wobblies.
Stuff.
He was a card-carrying member of the Wobblies, and unfortunately he chose not to hide that. And he was rounded up very quickly. He was put in jail in Vancouver temporarily until he could be tried. His family tried to get him out of prison, out of the reformatory, arguing that he had a clean record, which indeed he did to that point. But he did not hide the fact that he was a Wobbly, and it did end him up in prison. He was very bitter following that. He was bitter about the way he felt fate had treated his father and family. He was bitter that he ended up in the state reformatory, and he never shed that bitterness.
Hmm. It sounds like he got hardened by being there.
Very definitely. In fact, when he got out of the reformatory, he went to Chicago hoping to meet the likes of Al Capone and maybe get some career advice. He did that, and it didn't work out. Nobody was really very interested in Ray D'Autremont's crime career.
Wow. Let's take a call here. It's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13 with its author, Scott Mangold.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Well, maybe this is a little early on. The program's half over, but I was just going to ask this kind of, I guess it would be an ironic question. If they were going to use this dynamite in an effort to halt the train, why couldn't they have just robbed the place where they had gotten the dynamite from? from in the first place. And Jeffrey, I'll just take Scott's answer off of the phone here.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. In fact, they had stolen the dynamite and the detonator, hadn't they?
They did indeed. After they bought their car, they began reconnoitering the area to look for crime opportunities. What they found was a construction project near the Oregon City train station where a construction company was putting in another track. It was after hours. There was nobody in the area. The Deotremont boys discovered that they could walk right into the site. In doing that, they found a case of dynamite. And their plan with the dynamite was only that it would be Plan B. What they planned to do was stop a train as it came through the tunnel and slowed down for a brake test. And the dynamite would be used only if they couldn't coax the... Actually, he was a mail clerk. He was not a Fourth Railroad man, but mail clerk Elvin Dougherty was in the car immediately behind the locomotive and tender, and it was he who would open up, or not, the car and make it available, any of its contents, to the boys. The Deotremonts had everything positioned, including a detrimator. They stole the dynamite. They were, at the time, working in a lumber camp near Silverton. But the first opportunity they had, they jumped in the car, had the dynamite and the detonator, came down to the area of Tunnel 13 to reconnoiter, and it was only after they couldn't convince Dougherty, the mail clerk, to open the door that they blew it with dynamite. They used the whole case. One or two sticks would have sufficed, probably, to open that door, but they used the whole case of dynamite. And, of course, it incinerated the car, the contents, and the mail clerk, Elvin Dougherty.
So back up a couple of steps here. They bought a car. If these guys were hungry and home, what were they doing with a car? How could they afford to buy a car?
They had saved a little money. An older brother, Vern, probably provided them, not knowing what they were going to do with it, provided them with some money. And during a holiday weekend, they went from Silverton to Portland. And the Burnside Auto Company on West Burnside had a dandy little green used 1918 Nash touring car. This was the perfect car as they saw it. The only problem was only Hugh knew how to drive. So much of their time in the next few weeks involved teaching the twins to drive so that they'd be a little more versatile with their automobile. They had planned to stow the car near the summit and to take off as soon as they got the gold out of the held-up train, but that's where things started going wrong, and in fact, they did not use the car. It had no significant role in the crime.
Other than to get them to the crime scene. So tell me again, so was it the dynamite blast that killed the clerk in the mail car?
Yes. Ray and Roy positioned a suitcase full of dynamite between the mail car and the locomotive's tender. And when it was clear that the mail clerk would not open the door for them, Roy, who had a 12-gauge shotgun in his hand, took a shot at the car, mostly to convince the mail clerk to open the door. He did not, so at that point they wasted no more time. They had strung out the wire from the dynamite to the detonator, had hooked that up, and the only thing that was different from what they had rehearsed was Ray, who had some knowledge of dynamite, was going to be the one to detonate it. He did not. Roy lost his composure, and he went out and fell on the plunger and detonated it, and it was quite a conflagration.
It sounds like it really, the car was incinerated, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Not immediately. Actually, the dynamite did not set other than a few small fires in the car. It was possible for folks to get into the car briefly. But later, when the car was moved out of the tunnel, there was a draft that followed it. You can imagine air rushing through a tunnel. And it just took off in one big ball of fire.
One of our listeners had asked if this is the same tunnel that caught on fire a few years ago and then had to go through extensive repairs.
It is. I'm trying to remember. I'm going to say 6 years ago. I could be wrong. Ostensibly, someone had set the fire accidentally or on purpose, vagrants, perhaps. And the fire lasted for several days and required an awful lot of, the tunnel required an awful lot of repair and construction.
It looks like the fire was actually in 2004, so 9 years ago now. Quite a while. And in fact, we talked to somebody last year or 2 years ago who actually was making guitars.
Yes.
Out of the timbers.
Yes, we met him. Quite an interesting gentleman, and had written a song, I think.
He did as well, yes, indeed. So the process that these guys, it sounds like what happened was these were not guys ready for a life of crime, didn't know it themselves, of course, and I suppose that's what makes the story so poignant. These were people who otherwise might have been halfway decent chaps, but they got into the situation where their planning was awful, their execution was worse, and they ended up with four people's blood on their hands.
Yes. Mixed signals. It's interesting that the boys had a number of good aspects, a number of things that they had done, but the whole time they planned this train robbery, they planned that they would leave no one behind. They didn't want anybody to recognize them. It could shorten their career considerably.
Well, they certainly ensured that. We'll come back and take the story up from there. The book is called Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13. Scott Mangold wrote it. He's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join the conversation when we come back in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Scott Mangold, a Rogue Valley resident and amateur historian. His book about the famous intended robbery that turned into a quadruple murder in Southern Oregon almost exactly 90 years ago. It's 90 years ago tomorrow. It is called Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13. D'Autrement's Hold Up the Southern Pacific. We're talking about Ray, Roy, and Hugh D'Autrement, the brothers who committed the crime and eventually served time for it. You can join our discussion on the exchange about Tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13. Phone number is 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking before the break about the fact that the brothers had decided in advance if there were any witnesses, those witnesses were going to die.
Yes.
And that was essentially what motivated the murders of the train crew members.
Yes, and I think it's when we first saw the brothers as being very cold-hearted.
Did they wear masks or anything else to try to disguise themselves at the scene of the crime?
No, in fact, they tried something that was considered fairly unique among train robbers at the time. They committed the crime in broad daylight, and at the top of a mountain, a tunnel going through it. Crimes to that point had generally been conducted at night so that no one would be seen. But I guess they figured that if they were going to kill any witnesses anyway, why mess around with masks?
Okay, so the stop was regular, though.
It was regular.
Because it's the beginning of a downgrade?
Yes, it was the summit. And Southern Pacific rules and procedures required that the train slow to a speed of 3-4 miles an hour while the brakes were tested through a considerable process.
And the tunnel's almost half a mile long, so was the train entirely contained within it during this stop?
It was. In fact, the book contains a map of the tunnel and the train passing through it. The train consisted of the locomotive, the tender, 8 cars, and actually there was another section behind, several minutes away, was what was called train 213.
Second
13.
First and second. Which I didn't realize until reading your book, that the train actually ran in two sections that day, simply because the load of passengers was that great.
The load of passengers and the weight, yes. It carried a lot of express as well.
So, and this, you mentioned at least somewhere in the literature surrounding the release of your book from your publisher, which is the History Press, indicates that you had access to some information that might not have been available to previous authors.
One of the things that inspired me to write this was one of my co-volunteers at the Southern Oregon Historical Society found in a family location a copy of the trial testimony. There were actually 2 trial testimonies amounting to about 600 pages, But the first one gave me everything I needed to see that there were inaccuracies in the story as the story has been portrayed recently. So I read and digested this. We also found what's called the photo album. Back at the time of the crime, the post office, and they were incensed by this crime that would cost them the life of one of their people.
It was the clerk actually worked for the Railway Mail Service, I'm guessing.
Yes. He actually worked for the post office, mm-hmm. Post office department. But
the inaccuracies about the story, you said.
Yes, inaccuracies of the story. Besides finding the trial testimony, we found this photo album that the post office had put together using, oh gosh, more than 100 photographs. And there are many of the photographs that appear in the other books that have been written as well. But I found a number. I befriended a fellow at the National Postal Museum and another at National Archives, and they were able to help me find a number of pictures from the photo album, which had disappeared for about 25 years. They found the album. We were able to use pictures. We also found a few pictures at the Southern Oregon Historical Society that pertained but had never been used before. So the book does contain a lot of photography, pictures that hadn't been published before.
One aspect of the story that you bring up probably better than previous versions that I've read about this is the whole issue of the fact that we are talking about a trainload of passengers here. It all seems very isolated. We know we're talking about the west end of the tunnel and all that sort of thing and where all the activity took place. But the fact is there was a trainload of passengers back there. What was going on back in the passenger cars while all this, the explosion and the sounds of the gunshot and ultimately four people dead?
That interested me a great deal when I considered whether or not to do this project. What were all of those people doing? There were about 100 people on the train. I say about back then with passengers getting on and off, it wasn't always easy to determine exactly what your load was. But we guesstimate that there were about 100 people on board, and about 25 of them are what in the airline industry we called non-revs, workers shuttling to their next assignment, families who had passes to ride.
Oddly enough, the railroad calls them deadheaders because they're just deadheading. They're not actually working that trip.
Exactly right, deadheaders. And I wondered what became of these people. We had a copy of a diary from a passenger. She was an employee's wife. Mary wrote diary pages during the crime. She was on the train, and she depicts horrible confusion. Windows were breaking. People were getting cuts from the glass. And I had never seen anything. I read the three books before and all the magazine articles. We had never seen anything about the passengers getting out of the tunnel. And in fact, with a lot of reading, I was able to determine that the locomotive from Second 13 was used. That train pulled up outside the tunnel shortly after the explosion, and there was a helper engine on the front of that locomotive, as on First 13, and that was very quickly disconnected, was uncoupled, and with deadhead conductors, Stanton, and I can't remember the other gentleman's name, they took the locomotive, the helper locomotive, off the front of Second 13, proceeded into the tunnel. If you look at a map, only a few feet of the tunnel, only a few yards were occupied by the train. The tunnel was so much deeper than the train was long. It was quite a distance from that opposite end, from the east end to the train. But the two conductors and the locomotive engineer took this helper engine in to the tunnel, proceeded more than halfway through the tunnel till it reached the train, disconnected the train, there's quite a story behind that, connected the helper locomotive, and pulled the passengers back out in the original train. And it was just mass confusion. The telegraph was going crazy. Nobody knew who was in charge.
And I imagine the line would have been closed for a while anyway. It's not like trains could get around. We're talking a single track through that tunnel and no other way around. And this is when the Siskiyou line was actually the main line of the Southern Pacific. There was no line through Klamath Falls, the one that Amtrak uses today.
Right.
So this was, we're really talking a main artery of travel and commerce on the West Coast. Closed for how long, do we know?
The line was closed only for a few hours. Mary, in her diary, says that the train left about 7 p.m. that night. The crime was midday. The train was due through about 12:30 in the afternoon.
All right, so this is a train that actually would have left Portland, I'm thinking, the night before.
The night before, it traveled overnight. The locomotive and the crews were changed in Ashland, actually at other points too, but the affected crew boarded the train in Ashland. And then there was the second train a few minutes behind. As I mentioned, both of the trains had a helper locomotive on the front. They would be taken off at Siskiyou. There was a small station at Siskiyou and a turntable for turning the locomotives around so that they could go back to their next helper assignment out of Ashland.
That was another picture I'd never seen before, the presence of the turntable up at Siskiyou, right up there at the summit. And if people are curious about where the tunnel is, as you drive up to the Mount Ashland ski area and Colstein Road drops off to the left, the tunnel runs right under that ridge.
That's right.
Over the road right there. And in fact, if you look carefully, you can see the poles from the old railroad telegraph wires.
Yes.
Going up and over the tunnel.
Yes, there still is interesting things up there to look at that date back pretty close to the time of the crime.
So we haven't talked much about what happened once the D'Otterman brothers took off. They couldn't use their car, you figured, because they assumed they'd be followed in that. So where did they go? They went west over the mountains on foot?
Part of their reconnoitering was setting up a couple of campsites, and they found an area that they called their cache, where trees had fallen over a creek. And if all else failed and they had to hide for a while, they would use their cache. Well, they did. And they were in that cache, which is west of the tunnel exit, about 2 miles. They used that cache for 10, 11, or 12 days. They lost track with everything going on. For several days, in fact, for maybe a week, they snuck off the side of the mountain away from their cache, and they proceeded downhill along the railroad through some lumber camps, proceeded downhill, doing the best they could to get away. Of course, there were airplanes overhead. National Guard was active. Anybody who might be a law enforcement officer was involved in this and trying to find the D'Otterman brothers. Well, they were sneaking down into California as best they could, and they succeeded. They got away. It's miraculous. Again, many stories. But they knew that three of them traveling together was not going to be successful for long, so they broke up below Hilt on the Pacific Highway. Ray left first, and he headed towards Southern California. A few hours later, Hugh and Roy also left the site. They went towards Yreka. In the town of Montague, got to stop and keep the twins straight here.
Ray and Roy, right.
Yeah, Ray and Roy, constant confusion. They found a farmer, cutting hay in his field, and they decided that one of them, Roy, would stay and work on the farm while Hugh would continue south. Their travels are very interesting. Probably what's most important is Ray went to the San Diego area. Hugh eventually gravitated to Chicago and joined the Navy. Excuse me, joined the Army. Boy, that was a bad mistake. Joined the Army, and he was eventually captured in 1927, February of 1927. The twins did, with a lot of planning, get back together again. They were captured in the Ohio area.
So 3.5 years later, and let's advance the story a little bit. Here's Rosie in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13 with its author, Scott Mangold.
Hi, how do you spell the last name, Scott's last name?
Mangold.
I'd love to get the book. I have always known that my grandfather was supposedly the judge on the trial. Now, I think you mentioned there were two trials, and I'm sorry to get in on so late, but I just thought I would call and see if you had any information about the judge that presided over the court.
All right, thanks for the question, Rosie. Appreciate it. Scott?
Hi, Rosie. Judge Thomas was the circuit court judge who presided over the trial. And George Nooner and George Roberts were the two chief prosecutors. Again, many stories, very interesting. But your grandfather would have been C.W. Thomas.
Thanks for that, Rosie. Appreciate it. So just to finish up here then, what happened? The brothers went to prison, obviously. Now, did Ray and Roy actually, they pled guilty, didn't they? Went on the mercy of the court to avoid hanging?
Yes, they did. Actually, the first to be tried, the only planned trial was that of Hugh after he was captured in the Philippines and brought back to Jacksonville. But there was wheeling and dealing that went on such that if he was found guilty, he would not be executed. He would go to prison for life without opportunity of parole. So he had beaten the death sentence, and everybody was just shocked that this would be the case. This was a heinous crime.
And so they all served time. Hugh, I understand, was let out for compassionate reasons a few months before he died of cancer. Is that right?
Actually, no. He was paroled. He was paroled in 1957, 1958, and went to the Bay Area. He was a printer. He took up printing in prison and actually did a lot of work for the state of Oregon. But
Ray lived long enough to get out on parole. What happened to Roy?
Roy was the one who had a lobotomy in 1950. He had been schizophrenic for a number of years. In the state prison in Salem, the two boys were allowed to room together. They were cellmates. Roy became belligerent. It's ironic. He was very religious in his earlier life. There was concern that he would hurt someone. There were, in fact, a couple of episodes. But he was in prison. He was the one who, although paroled, he never left custody. Ray, on the other hand, was paroled, and a job was found for him at the University of Oregon as a custodian.
So a horrific crime with a very long afterlife, one we're still talking about, 90 years almost to the day. It actually was 90 years ago tomorrow, October 11th. The tragedy at Southern Oregon Tunnel 13, the Autrymans hold up the Southern Pacific, Scott Mangold's book. Scott, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Same here. Great to have you. Tomorrow, we'll talk about winter energy bills, fire prevention week, and we'll talk to Alice Hoffman, the novelist, about her nonfiction book, Survival Lessons. That's all tomorrow on The Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.